Congressman Crowley will not be able to join us this morning. As I'm sure many of you have followed the events since Sunday with the passing of Osama bin Laden, Congressman Crowley's time will be required in New York today. I'm sure 9/11 has touched all of us in many different ways, but as you may not be aware, Congressman Crowley was the only member of Congress at the time who actually suffered a loss in the World Trade Center. So he unfortunately won't be able with us this morning. I think in all of our lives there are certain times where there's places we should be. Clearly this is one of those for him. But we do still have a very, very interesting discussion to have this morning and an excellent panel. You all have bios with you, but I will just briefly introduce all of our speakers. Walter Peck, to my right here, is the Director General for the International Affairs Bureau of the Grand National Party in Korea. The Grand National Party, as I'm sure many of you know, is currently the majority party in Korea, and he will be able to take and provide us with all of the insight we're looking for into the situation in Korea this morning. To my left is Brian Pomper, who is a partner at Akin Gump. As I'm sure many of you are aware, was the former International Trade Council for Chairman Max Baucus. And Tim Keeler is currently the Counsel for Government Affairs and Global Trade at Mayor Brown, and previously was the Chief of Staff to Susan Schwab. So with that, I will move into our conversation. In the last couple of weeks, there have been a series of trips to Korea by members of Congress, both in the House and the Senate. Earlier, Congressman Crowley was going to take and discuss with us sort of what he had learned during his time there. But Tim, I know many Republicans have also gone to Korea recently. Could you perhaps give us an impression of sort of what they heard and how those trips went?
Thank you for first hosting us here, and look forward to a very good discussion. My understanding, it was a very good, productive trip. Obviously, the relations between the two countries and the two governments are very good right now, and that was reflective in what I heard from staff of the senators who were on the trip, and particularly for Senator Portman, who launched the FTA negotiations. I think it was a nice reuniting, and he pledged to get it through the Senate as quickly as possible.
Thank you. Do you have any insight into how the Democrats have?
No, I mean, I think everybody's pretty supportive of this. I mean, I think, frankly, Mr. Crowley is really eager to make sure that there's a good, strong support for this in the Democratic caucus in the House when it comes up for passage. So I think he's working. Trade votes are pretty controversial in the Democratic caucus. They won't say that they're whipping it, but I think he's doing his best to try to make sure there'll be a really strong turnout of Democrats in support of the agreement when it comes up.
Walter, let's touch on some of yesterday's events. We know that recently there had been some issues in terms of passing the EU-Korea FTA, but late yesterday in Korea, the EU-Korea FTA finally passed. Could you kind of give us a little context for what had been going on in Korea and then sort of how those situations were resolved yesterday?
Sorry, let me read very carefully to give good information to you. So thank you, Dr. Stenger, and the distinguished guest, Mr. Brian Pomper and Mr. Timothy Keeler. Good morning. Before I begin my discussion, I'd like to express my thanks to the Ambassador Jack Pritchard and Dr. Abraham Kim and my KI friends to let me have this prestigious opportunity to deliver the Seoul side story on this important issue. So the doctor had asked regarding the Korea-EU FTA. Before I start that, you told about the U.S. delegation to Seoul last weekend, led by the Secretary of Commerce, Gary Rock, and there were some senior House members together, like the Congressman Ranger, or McDermott, and Joseph Crowley, and David Rehart, such members. They had a meeting with the floor leaders of both the ruling the Grand National Party and the main opposition Democratic Party last weekend. I was attending at the meeting with the Grand National Party floor leader Kim Moo-sung and the U.S. delegation last Friday. So let me just explain you how the Korea-EU FTA was processed in Korea. Korea-EU FTA was signed by both sides' trade ministers in October 2010, and it was ratified by the EU Parliament in February this year. And in January, Song Gi-ho, a lawyer of Minbyeon. Minbyeon is a Korea's Lawyers for a Democratic Society, which is a progressive group of lawyers. He was the first person to make public mistranslations in the Korean language version of the Korea-EU FTA. In January, Song had found that many parts of a translation into Korean version was wrong, so he immediately publicized that through his columns on newspapers. In the meantime, the many assembly members of the opposition parties and the anti-commerce groups discovered mistranslations in Korean version too and asked for a review. So in February, Korea's trade minister Kim Jong-un said that the review of the entire Korea-EU FTA found 207 errors, and later discovered that the COROS and SEPA with India, SEPA means the Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement with India, and even ratified agreement contained a lot of mistranslations. So in early April, MOFET, Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade of Korea, had withdrawn Bill of Consent for Korea-EU FTA from National Assembly and immediately submitted a new translated version again. However, the opposition parties rejected of unsatisfied government safeguard plans, especially on the agricultural field and the local small business owners. Through the many times of the negotiations between the ruling party and opposition parties, both of the Grand National Party and administration had agreed to implement sufficient measures over the opposition parties' concerned matters. So, was supposed to vote on April 29 after it was ratified by the Foreign Affairs, Trade and Unification Committee of the National Assembly on April 28. However, after this consent bill was passed by Foreign Affairs Committee, some the hawk members of main opposition Democratic Party and anti-government NGOs criticized the Democratic Party that it was not enough. Then Democratic Party boycotted the plenary session of April 29. So since the motion was failed at the April session, the GNP Florida called just one day the plenary session on May 4, which is yesterday, to vote for the Korea-EU FTA. As you may know, the Korean National Assembly has extraordinary sessions during the even number months, February, April, and June. August is a vacation, so no sessions. So on May 4, yesterday, National Assembly passed the Korea-EU FTA while the Democratic Party boycotted it. In the morning of yesterday, at the Democratic Party meeting, majority of Democratic Party Assembly members voted against passing the bill while criticizing their leadership. So Democratic Party floor leader Park Ji-won suggested the Grand National Party for further discussions, but was rejected by GNP floor leader. The GNP floor leader argued that the GNP has acceded and conceded almost 90% of Democratic Party's demands in order to reach the compromise. But it seemed that the Democratic Party is still unwilling to accept it. So that is why we took it to the plenary session alone. So very late at night, the Grand National Party passed the bill, and fortunately there was no physical violence. because the Democratic Party had boycotted, that means they did not attend at the session. So that is this short story for the Korea-EU FTA. And this the agreement will be take effect from the perhaps the, from the July 1st.
Thank you, Walter. Now, Brian, moving to one of yesterday's announcements from USTR, as we all know, beef has been one of the main stumbling blocks for the CORUS FTA since before the talks even started. One of the announcements from both USTR and Senator Baucus seems to have provided some, at least a path forward potentially on this issue. Could you give us an idea of sort of what was in this agreement and how it will affect things going forward?
Sure. So, no secret, the chairman's long been really concerned about the treatment of beef in the Korean Free Trade Agreement back in 2006 when we had the negotiating round in Big Sky, Montana. He made the statement then, he wouldn't move the agreement unless Korea came into full compliance with its World Animal Health Organization requirements, or OIE requirements. And Tim, when he was at USTR, helped to negotiate effectively an agreement that would lead in that direction, which led to widespread protests in Korea in the summer of 2008. And I think really on every side, in the Korean side and in the US side, I think we underestimated the political volatility and sensitivity of that particular issue in Korea. But nevertheless, and then ultimately, this is actually quite loud. I don't know if it's possible to turn it down.
Yeah, mine's apparently quite soft, so
yeah.
You can just maybe
sign it to move down my tie a little bit. There we go. I think Tim can talk much more in depth about the interior goings-on of this at the time. It almost brought down the government, the Korean government at the time. So this really was a very difficult issue, and we're able to negotiate out a resolution of that which did not comport with OIE standards. It's always been a thorn in the chairman's side. So he had continued to press and has moderated his demands gradually as time went on, as he came, I think, to understand better the politics in Korea, but nevertheless felt pretty strongly, how can I, as the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, advocate for the passage of a free trade agreement which does not, with a country that does not meet our OIE standards, how can I then go out to countries with whom we don't have free trade agreements, like Japan and Taiwan and these other places, and tell them, well, you've got to meet OIE standards, even though our free trade agreement partner doesn't, and I acquiesced in that. So that, I think, has been his mantra. Ultimately, what was in the announcement yesterday and had been long in the works, it was really kind of a two-prong solution for the chairman. There exists in the text of the CORUS FTA the ability for the United States to request consultations with the government of Korea on these sorts of issues, the beef protocol issues. So, effectively, yesterday, Ambassador Kirk sent a letter to Chairman Baucus committing that he would request those consultations on getting beef of all ages and all cuts into Korea soon after the agreement enters into force. That's the first prong. The second prong works out to about $11 million from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to promote U.S. beef inside South Korea. So that, I think, gave the chairman some comfort. It is a big step towards what he ultimately wants, you should not take it to mean that he's going to go away on these issues. I think he'll continue to beat up on Korea on this. He wants full OIE compliance, and I've said long, and many of you here have probably heard me say, he's right. He's right on this issue in principle. But this, I think, gave him enough comfort to be able to at least allow the process to go forward in his committee. At this point, I don't see him being a big cheerleader for the agreement in the same way that he has been for Colombia. I think he'll support it. I think he'll let the process go forward. And I think it'll get a huge vote in the Senate. I'd say it'll easily get more than 80 votes, maybe even approaching 90 votes.
Wow. Tim, Brian had mentioned that you worked in the original beef agreement. Is there any contextual part you want to maybe add to this?
I think Brian captured it well. They were I don't think anybody predicted we would have gotten the agreement that we did in the first place, that was a pretty clear and deadline-laden path to full OIE compliance, and nobody would have predicted that there would have been a million Koreans in the streets over you know, hamburger beef, essentially, that we eat every day here. We did what we had to do in figuring out a way to, we didn't use the word renegotiate, you know, but to come up with a modus operandi that would allow beef trade to move forward and also essentially save the fight for another day. I have to imagine at some point, Korea will be leading the way for all the countries in Asia to actually go into meeting their international obligations pursuant to OIE. So. Okay.
Walter, beef, as Brian mentioned and Tim reiterated, has been a very sensitive issue for Korea. How do you think that this announcement from USTR and Senator Baucus will be received in Korea?
I said until this morning that I have checked the internet that what's going on in Korea. So in Korea, today, May 5th, is Children's Day. So it's a holiday in Korea. So I could not check any specific comments or reaction from the important persons or the important organizations or parties yet. So, however, personally, I think this is a good sign to both countries. The Senator Baucus took the positive the steps toward Korus. So personally, I welcome and respect Senator Baucus. This is very personally.
And I'll just say, I mean, I think he does view it as a win. I mean, he sort of hung out there for a long time. I think there were people who, you know, questioned why he was being so hard on this. But I have to underscore, I think he was right. Principle, it made sense. And he did, I think, take a big step towards what he ultimately wants.
One of the other things that USTR announced yesterday was that they would proceed with the technical drafting of the three FTAs starting this morning. How has this announcement been received on Capitol Hill? Why don't you go first?
Sure. And then I think both on and off Capitol Hill, I think there are a lot of people who are excited about it. You know, it's we've had this sort of stalled, sometimes we'll jokingly say constipated, you know, trade agenda with these three FTAs that have kind of been in the works for a long time. I mean, when the last vote we had was the fall of 2007, right, on Peru. So, you know, 3.5 years, gone on almost 4 years. It's a long time, I think, without a trade agreement vote when you've got them. So people are really happy. They feel like the process is moving forward. But I would just say, and I know Tim will echo this, that it's a little early to be popping champagne corks. There's still quite a few, and I would say sizable hurdles to get over. I have every confidence that we will. It's just going to be pretty tough. There's going to be a lot of discussions over the next couple of weeks and months how to move the process forward.
Well, Tim, one of those hurdles has been the Colombia FTA. One of the things that I saw this morning in the papers was that the administration has basically said, listen, we still need them to continue on the action plan and don't expect the Colombia FTA to take and come up right away. How do you think that's going to impact the process going forward?
Well, I agree. The news yesterday was good. And the other good news is nobody is really drawing hard lines in the sand publicly right now on all of these issues, Colombia, TAA, whatever it may be. The good news, I think, sort of ends right there because there's big problems, and my biggest worry is that the amount of time it may take to solve those problems. I don't see Republicans moving ahead with into a process where there isn't a fair amount of certainty that all three FTAs will get done in a relatively short period of time. And procedurally, it's also difficult to see exactly how TAA fits into that equation. Again, the good news is because these talks can begin on technical discussions, nobody has to make any hard decisions right now about some of these procedural and some trust-building exercises can happen because they just, if the president wanted to send at the FTAs today, he couldn't do it. There's got to be this work done. There's got to be mock markups. But it is, I mean, everybody agrees the FTAs need to get done and hopefully done this summer. There are some big hurdles and some big gaps in trust exactly what goes first and how it all plays out.
Now, Tim, you had mentioned TAA, and earlier this year, the House had tried to pass an extension of TAA. In USTR's release, they said that they would like to see TAA move in parallel with the FTAs. Do you think something that's possible now that the FTA should be moving forward, or do you think there still might be issues in the House with TAA?
I mean, there's definitely issues in the House with TAA. There's no doubt about it, and that's part of the problem. And part of the challenge in getting the FTAs done quickly. And I think, again, publicly, it's one thing to mention TAA. I'm happy to see nobody's drawing lines in the sand. I know I can say what a lot of Republicans view the issue as is in 2002, there was Trade Promotion Authority that had negotiating objectives, and that is what these FTAs were done pursuant to, and the negotiating objectives were met. And you had the May 10th deal that layered some new requirements, but it was a compromise. And a lot of Republicans feel like procedurally, there was no other way to do it. The Bush administration at the time had to do its part of the bargain first, but they don't feel like it was fully reciprocated on the other side. And that's sort of why there's still gaps in trust as to how everything should move forward. Now you've also had Korea with a new negotiation on the sideline. You've had Panama with the issue of taxes being brought into the fold, and you've had Colombia with the Labor Action Plan. So there's been lots of new things happening. And I think because of that, Republicans will resist the idea that before the FTAs have sort of a certain path or even transmitted that you'd have to have TAA passing first. It would be very surprising to me to see Republicans comfortable with anything that smacked of that, because first of all, that'll take time. And second of all, it'll bring back a lot of memories of May 10th deal where Republicans had to go first, and that's not necessarily the case here with respect to how all these things play out.
Now, Brian, how do you see that playing out on the Democratic side, especially if TAA, we'll say, perhaps has to fall slightly behind?
Yeah, this is obviously, Tim and I have talked a lot about this in the last few days, and I think you left out one additional step that I think Republicans felt like they had to eat a little bit of crow on to get the trade agenda moving. That was in 2009. When there was a sizable expansion of the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program for 2 years that passed as part of the stimulus bill at the time. And this was what the Republican leaders tried to pass in the fall or winter, I think, of 2010 recently, in December, I think, I can't remember exactly when it was an extension, I believe, of the 2009 program. And they faced a little bit of a revolt among their ground troops, especially among those identified with the Tea Party caucus, that this is effectively a program that was in the stimulus. And it costs money, and they weren't really excited about passing it. That was a bill that was on suspension, so you needed two-thirds of the House to pass it. And ultimately, when the Speaker saw that his conference was rebelling a little bit against it, he pulled the vote. So, to Tim's point, I think on the Republican side, there's a little bit of a sense of grievance that they've bent over more than backwards to try to get the trade agenda moving for what some will call the Bush FTAs, to get them, you know, moving along. On the other hand, on the Democratic side, TAA has been in effect in some form or fashion for 50 years. It has always been, in the modern era, the flip side of trade agreements. It's the other side of the coin. And from Democratic sensibilities, you cannot have one without the other. You haven't since the Kennedy administration. The 2009 enhancement of TAA expired at the end of last year. Democrats would very much like to see an extension of that for a certain period, 5-10 years maybe. They'd love to see that extended. Republicans do not want to see that extended. But we're not even just talking about 2009, which has expired. We're actually talking about the entire program. Reauthorized, tied to the Trade Act of 2002, back in 2002, it was authorized for 10 years. It expires in February of 2012. So the entire program expires early next year, less than a year from now. And from a Democratic standpoint, it's very hard for me to see, and I'm fairly confident in saying, neither Democrats in the administration nor on Capitol Hill will want to allow the free trade agreements to go forward without a significant degree of comfort that TAA is going to be extended for a significant period of time. And I would say probably not just the background 2002 program, but perhaps some combination of 2009-2002. That's a very big hurdle, because really we're saying diametrically opposed things, right? Tim is saying no TAA before the FTA is passed. And I'm saying no FTAs before TAA passes. Now, as Tim says, none of the political leaders have made that statement publicly. They're hinting around it. And privately, I think those are certainly the signals that I'm getting from both sides. That's our task over the course of the next weeks and months, is to figure out how that kind of settles down.
Now, just to touch on one other side issue on this real quick, what I remember from the attempt to reauthorize it was that it became a funding issue, and that Ways and Means had come up with what they thought was a means to do it, especially under the new rules, but that compromise, I guess, was rejected. Do we see this still being a funding issue, or is it ultimately really going to be a principal issue of sort of whether the FTAs go first or parallel, you know, sort of the broader issues you and Tim have just discussed?
Yes. Yeah.
Good answer.
It's both, truly. I mean, you do have the sequencing issues, but you're right. These things are not inexpensive. I think if you were to extend the 2009 program in toto, it would cost somewhere between $6 and $8 billion over a 10-year period. That's not chump change. And frankly, the FTAs themselves are going to cost money too, especially Korea. This is a big deal. We don't the typical way that the Congress will pay for these trade agreements is through customs user fees. But customs user fees have been used in the last few months to pay for other priorities. So there aren't enough customs user fees to pay for the FTAs or for TAA. Put the two together, it's a pretty sizable bill, and I'm not sure how you pay for that. That's a whole separate heartache that the folks on Capitol Hill are going to have to figure out.
Okay. Well, earlier on, you had mentioned you thought there'd be significant support in the Senate for the CORUS FTA. Let's move to the House vote for a few moments. I spent a little while going through sort of all of the previous votes. The one thing that sticks out is that, you know, we like to talk about trade being bipartisan, but in a lot of ways it really is, because if you look back, essentially, they've always required both Democratic and Republican support. You can't pass an FTA without support from both parties. So, Tim, do you see the Republicans being able to change that now and muster the support to take a pass course on their own if they needed to, or do you still think it's going to need bipartisan support to get through?
Oh, it's certainly going to need bipartisan support to get through, because, I mean, I don't think... Well, for one thing, I think to the extent votes became more identified with one party, it was bad for trade policy generally. I know Republicans don't want that necessarily, and I don't know. I don't think the votes, they would have the votes, nor would they want to try to twist the arms to even get the votes. That'll be part of the challenge. I think a lot of Republicans feel like they've actually been beat up quite a bit on the campaign trail by Democrats on trade issues. And so I think they'll be looking very much to the president to personally get as many Democratic votes as possible, so that you don't have a situation where one side or the other are having to make some of their members walk the plank for what is something that both the administration and the Republican leadership say are priorities to get the three FTAs done.
Well, now on the Democratic side, we know Sandra Levin has come out, strongly supports the CORUS FTA now. How do you see the votes looking on the Democratic side for this?
Yeah, I think they're quite strong. You know, as I mentioned, last FTA vote we had was for Peru. There was a real strong effort to try to get a majority of Democrats to support it, and they almost got there. I think there were 109 Democrats, so a dozen or so short maybe of the majority of Democrats at the time. I think you actually stand a chance of getting a majority of the Democrats to support Korea. I mean, you've got the difference between Peru and Korea is you now have a Democratic president who's going to whip real hard on this. You have Democratic leaders who really do want a strong show of support, and you've got two unions that have come out strongly in support of the agreement. Now you've got other unions that are opposed to it. There are still some issues, political issues, specifically with respect to textiles, which actually, ironically, may dampen some of the Republican support in textile states for Korea. But I think you're going to see. I'd be shocked if there were less than, say, 70 votes. And I wouldn't be shocked if you had, you know, even approaching 100, honestly, on the Korea FTA. But one point I want to make on this TA thing that I didn't make earlier. There is, I think, a sense in Republican circles that, for lack of a better word, the president is pregnant with these FTAs. That, you know, it's inevitable that they're going to pass, that he's so far out there with our allies, he's got to do it, TAA or no. And I'll just tell you, I don't really see it that way. And that's as Tim and I were talking. I don't think it's that there's not a diplomatic price to pay if they were to not to go forward at this point. But I will tell you, politically, domestically in the United States, there are still significant pressures on the president, both inside and outside of his administration, not to do these. So, I don't mean this as a messaging piece for Republicans. This is merely factual. That it is not the case that the administration is going to do these FTAs no matter what. There's still a lot of pressure for them not to do it. They want to do it. They want to go forward with it. I don't know that they would do that in the absence of this trade adjustment assistance or some sort of path forward where everybody can demonstrate faith and trust, exactly the sorts of things that don't appear to exist right now.
Well, speaking of outside pressure, one of the great unknowns coming into this debate was sort of how the Tea Party supported people would react on trade votes. The positive news was that early on, they all took, most of the House freshmen, not all, but signed on to a letter saying that they supported and wanted to see the FTAs go forward. Now, there's been some pushback from some of the actual Tea Party groups, none of the major ones, but some of the smaller ones at least. How do you think, Tim, that sort of the Tea Party influence will play out? Will they sort of hew more to that initial letter, or do you think ultimately pressure from outside might start perking up?
I don't think it'll probably change much from the letter. It wouldn't shock me if the letter was a high watermark in some sense, because it's one thing to sign a letter, but when there's a national debate and there's a vote on something, members have more information and hear from varied constituents and make judgments about what is the right thing to do. Everybody signed that letter knowingly, so I'd be surprised if there were many changes to it. And I don't think, I just don't think it really will be identified one way or the other as being really part of the Tea Party agenda. Therefore, it'll think be just governed more by more traditional instincts and constituent interests in general. So that's my take on it. I want to return to what Brian said, because this is really the heart of what are the interesting issues right now. I think Brian accurately characterized what the Republican view is right now of the incentive structure facing the Democrat or the administration more accurately, and he may well be right on how that plays out. It's my worry is if there has to be a negotiation on TAA, let's put it that way, one way or other, whether you link it, whether you don't link it. And negotiations take time. So when in this summer, when you've got debt limit negotiations, and if the stated goal of the administration is to get the FTAs done, or at least the Korea FTA done, by July 1st, it's very difficult for me to see how that calendar timeline works. And that means that they're going to have to choose between, make a choice between whether they want it done in that time frame or they don't. Because it's even, under very good faith negotiations, take time sometimes. And it's May, and it's less than 2 months to July 1st. And there's a lot of steps on the FDA process. That's, therein lies the rub right now.
Well, with that in mind, and we do know this takes time, assuming that there is no major breakdown or anything, that, things do work out, is there a timeline we should look to in terms of, all right, maybe July 1 isn't realistic, but, by the time they go out on August recess is or isn't? And
yeah, I think July 1st is quite optimistic, and frankly have long thought so. I think August 1st is still pretty optimistic. It's not certainly doable if everything falls into place. And I can tell you, I know, certainly at least on the Democratic side, that's really where they're looking. They're looking before the August recess. They definitely don't want to have to go back home for the August recess and hear from constituents in their districts, why are you doing these free trade agreements? What are you doing? They don't want to have to have that pressure back home. They want to do it before the August recess. And I'm sure it's true on the Republican side as well.
Well, Walter, if this is going to take longer in the United States than most people had at least been targeting, how does that sort of play out on the Korean side then?
Yeah.
In terms of timing and everything.
Last weekend at the meeting with the U.S. delegation, the GNP floor leader very clearly said that National Assembly will take only one step behind the U.S. Congress. So when the United States Congress takes one step in advance of Korean National Assembly, we'll try to match the speed to the U.S. Congress. That is the GNP leadership, the idea.
Okay. Let's go back to the announcement yesterday. There were a couple things that people have been talking about on the trade agenda that weren't brought up in USTR's announcements. That's the preference programs and Russian PNTR. Are these going to be part of a broader package, or are they things that now the administration has kind of decided, all right, there's a core group of issues we need to take and work on now, and we'll save those for a later time period? How do they kind of fit into the trade agenda now?
Well, my sense is sort of all the trade people in town are digesting all the things we're talking about right now. Because until you really got to this point, it wasn't even ripe to start thinking about, and maybe people in Washington should be more forward thinking than that, but such is life. I suppose it depends on how all of this plays out. Russian PNTR is a big lift in and of itself, and I tend to think that the congressional timeline will just depend more closely on the WTO accession timeline. Because it's going to be difficult for members to really get this on the agenda in a serious way until it becomes clear that the train in Geneva or the train from Moscow to Geneva, I suppose, has left the station and is moving ahead, and at a certain point the U.S. Would run the risk of having to do non-application when Russia accedes, and because of Jackson Vanik. That train is in the Russians' control, and everybody's getting on board. Stick with the metaphor, I guess. Everybody's getting on board. The passengers have their tickets bought, and they haven't actually left the station yet. Once they do, then it becomes much more real, and people are talking about that as still being a 2011 thing. I don't personally rule out that it can happen. Let's say at the end of this year, or even in an election year next year, because China PNTR did. It just becomes a different, that debate will be as much about foreign policy and about trade as a lot of the Jackson Vanik debates have been. And so I think it's eminently doable in an election year, if that's how it plays out. And I think it'll be a bipartisan support. You know, if we're talking about, I mean, it'll be a bad outcome if we're talking about the FTAs and all these larger things we're talking about having to sort of get wrapped into that sort of timeline, because there's that is, I think, everyone's viewing it as a different timeline right now. I think on preferences, they're not protected by TPA, which means it's going to have to go in an amendable vehicle, and you know, that's really the problem for TAA right now. It doesn't actually have a vehicle to move on, and that's sort of also causing all the larger sequencing problems that we're talking about, because some of these things, the FTAs have to effectively move on their own, certainly through the Senate, and it's got a different dynamic to it. So
I'll just add a little bit. Tim's absolutely right. The fact that TA has to move in an amendable vehicle, or should move in an amendable vehicle, I don't know if it's the right way to say it. Some folks have said, well, maybe you can put it into one of the FTAs, so it would be fast-track protected, an unusual precedent to say the least. But let's just take it as a given, it's an amendable vehicle. The problem with that is that it's an amendable vehicle, and it's the first real trade amendable vehicle in a while. So you could see all sorts of other issues making a guest appearance that, you know, may not have been invited to dinner, you know, like China currency, for instance, and some other issues that could come to the fore that would cause some discomfort for those in the political power structure. So that's a whole other heartache that we have here. So remember when I said earlier not to pop champagne corks?
I put the bottle right back here.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff still going on. But I'll say this too. I think if the one thing I happened to notice this, and I didn't notice in any other statements that were sent out yesterday. That doesn't mean they weren't in there. It just means I don't remember seeing it there. But I know in Mr. Camp's, Chairman Camp's statement yesterday, he did in fact reference WTO accessions and preference programs as well as TA. So it's not that it isn't on the radar screen. I think if Russia WTO accession is to move this year, I think it's a very late 2011 thing. It's not a light lift. There is not a lot of love lost in the Congress, I think, for Russia for a variety of reasons. And I think Russia, as has long been said by people much smarter than I, that Russia will suffer from the China experience, and that we are a little harder on Russia from the lessons that we learned in the China debate. But I my guess is this. If TAA moves, as I suspect it has to, I think GSP and ATPA will be attached to it. Now, there are other things out there. Customs reauthorization, like I said, China currency. I don't know how all this stuff gets played out. The majority leader, Reid, has said he wants something on China currency. He just took a big trip to China with a whole bunch of folks. A lot of moving pieces.
Right. Now, Walter, you've heard all the sort of the pieces we have here and everything. It's a very simple situation in the U.S. So let's move to Korea for a moment. Earlier in your comments, you had talked about the issues with the translation in the EU FTA. There have been some of those same issues with the U.S.-Korea FTA. Could you kind of let us know where things are on that?
The mistranslation. Yeah, I have told you that the trade minister admitted many the mistranslation from the chorus too. So yesterday on May 4th, the MOFED had withdrawn the bill of consent for chorus from National Assembly, and the National Assembly Foreign Affairs Committee had approved it. So the MOFED will do the process for a new translation works and submit a new translation version very soon. Early this week, before I came here, I met a very senior officer of MOFED and asked about this, the timetable. So he told me that the chorus correction process by the administration won't be take a long time, and will not be take a long time, because they are already doing that, And after they finish the translation the work, they will immediately, it will be immediately approved by cabinet meeting at the administration and forwarded to the National Assembly. So we can expect the to see submit again not too long, before not too long.
It's good to hear. When the Corps FTA was originally negotiated, it was negotiated by essentially what is now the opposition party in Korea. Could you give us a better understanding of sort of how the opposition in Korea views the Corus FTA today? And then also, in the U.S., some of the things that opponents in the U.S. have said is that basically there isn't any public support for the Corus FTA in Korea. Mm-hmm. Could you sort of give us a better feel for that as well?
Yes, the major opposition party, Democratic Party, even they have to change the names they did when they were in the ruling party, this chorus. So, however, now they are poised to oppose the pact, citing possible harm to the agriculture and other smaller industries in Korea. They also have voiced the concerns of excessive dependence on the U.S. economy. That means Korea economy may be too much rely on the U.S. economy than before. After the renegotiation of December, which was held in Maryland, Democratic Party argued that that negotiation of December was a kind of humiliating the diplomacy. So, as far as the objections related to chorus, to me, the Democratic Party seems to argue some following points. Number one is the Democratic Party thinks the last December 2010 negotiation was unfair for many reasons. And number two is that they have argued about the investor-state dispute clause. I'm not an expert for economy, so I'm analyzing this. So investor-state dispute resolution mechanism, they are arguing about this. And the other thing is the exclusion of the goods manufactured and produced in Kaesong. So that is another argument.
Are they for that or against that, or is the issue worrisome?
Yes, the KIC, Kaesong, the right, industrial complex.
But you said that's an issue, but you didn't say
and
why.
So not clear yet, but the Democratic Party wants to include the Kaesong produced items. While the U.S. side is reluctant to include
them. So they want Kaesong items allowed.
So it seems that the opposition parties, the Democratic Labor Party and the New Progressive Party, it seems to me they are almost unconditionally opposing against the chorus. They are absolutely against the chorus, it seems to me. And you have asked me whether in Korea, chorus gets the small number of supporting rate, such things there. According to a poll conducted by Korea's major newspaper, Dongha Ilbo, in January, that was right after the completion of chorus renegotiation, 55.2% of Korean people supported the chorus, and only 28% opposed the chorus. This is a big change from previous poll of June 2008, while we were having just the first version of the negotiation. At that time, 47% supported the chorus and 36% opposed. So now, from this year, after the renegotiation, we can see the chorus is getting a stronger support than before. So
let's say the policy is the was making the consensus Korean society.
Okay. Yes. Well, to sort of stick with the political theme in Seoul right now, we know that there were recently by-elections in Korea. How does that affect the political dynamic going forward?
Yes, the last week we had a by-election, and the by-election to elect one governor of a province and three national assembly members. The three assembly members, one is from metropolitan area, and one is the southeast area, which is called Gyeongsang province area, and the other is the southwest area, which is Jeolla province. Each of the regions represent very the symbolic reason for the election. So we, GNP, was really defeated at the by-election. So we lost the governor and Gangwon province, which is now trying to host the Pyeongchang Winter Olympic Games. And even in metropolitan area, that area was regarded as very, very GNP strong district. That is a new planned city, just 20 years of history. During the 20 years, the GNP candidate never was defeated at that metropolitan Bundang area. The name is Bundang. So every candidate collected and was supported almost 80% of voters during the previous election. But this time, Democratic Party Chairman Son Hak-kyu, he ran for the election himself at the GNP strong district. So he won. So we were defeated. So as this by-election had a greater impact for the next year's general and presidential election, so our GNP is shocked by this result, which was held in April 27. This is last Wednesday. So now the GNP leadership last weekend had resigned, including the chairman of GNP and the leadership, which means the members of the Supreme Council, they all had resigned. So now the GNP is under the process of organizing on the emergency committee. Tomorrow, which is May 6th, we'll have the in-party election to elect the new floor leader. In both ruling GNP and Democratic Party, we are just giving a one-term year to floor leaders. So this is not related to the outcome of the by-election. Just we will elect our new GNP floor leader tomorrow, and the Democratic Party will have an election on May 13th. After this floor leader is elected, the GNP may have a party convention to elect a new chairperson and the Supreme Council members. The new leadership will have the right to line up the party candidates for the next year's general election. I think the GNP party convention may be held in June. For your information, as I've told you briefly, normally we don't have sessions, the assembly sessions in odd numbered months. And as the regular session begins from early September, it goes to the December. No session in August. But in terms of chorus, there is a possibility for a short period of extraordinary session only for chorus in July and August, as we did yesterday. In May, we don't have any extra session, but the majority party, I mean the ruling party floor called one day the plenary session to vote for the Korea EU FTA yesterday. So we can call and have it a very short period of extraordinary session during even during the July or the August. Yeah. that is after the new GMP leadership is organized. So I don't think that influence any negative effect to the chorus, because I strongly believe that the new GMP leadership will also be strongly committed to pass and ratify this chorus. On the other hand, the winning at the by-election, Democratic Party regained the very strong confidence for the elections of next year, two elections of next year. So I guess that Democratic Party will be more aggressive against the GNP for everything GNP does. So the chorus may be included. So Democratic Party may raise more the noisy arguments over chorus. We have to see that. And as all of us know here know that the chorus contains the political bias by anti-U.S. group in Korea. And that is much different from Korea EU FTA. So in EU FTA, we didn't have any political factor included in the political process. But for chorus, you remember some better remembrance during the past times. So I'd like to say that it will not be an easy way to ratify chorus at the National Assembly. I can say that it will not be easy railroading. So, however, I'd like to emphasize again that the President Lee Myung-bak and Korea's current administration and the GNP, the Grand National Party, have a very strong commitment to pass this. Now, even though we were defeated at the by-election last week, still, the Grand National Party holds 171 seats out of 299 of National Assembly, which is a unicameral system. And we have some small political parties, I can say conservative small political parties, who can be our colleagues. Future Hope Alliance, which is a very pro Madam Bakgeun-hye party, they have 11 members. And Lee Hwae-chang, you remember Lee Hwae-chang, Mr. Lee Hwae-chang's Liberal Forward Party, they have 18 members. Both of the two small conservative parties share the same view on chorus. So if we add up all the numbers onto the GNP, theoretically, we have 190 members out of 299. So we can expect the ratifying chorus at the National Assembly. So let me finish my domestic politics report here.
Thank you, Walter. Well, Brian, thinking about domestic politics in the U.S., there's one minor issue that we have to do going forward no matter what, and that's the debt ceiling. How do you think the political debate about the debt ceiling will end up playing into the Congress's ability to take and actually move forward on the free trade agreements?
Yeah, I think, by the way, it depends who you talk to. Some you have to do. I think this process that Tim and I have laid out with TAA and the FTAs and all the other issues out there is going to require a lot of trust and kind of good working relationships, and I think that will be frayed by the debt limit, potentially. We've had this moment in the aftermath of the bin Laden raid where people have come together, but I think it will be short-lived. I think more than anything, the schedule will be difficult, right, because it's going to be taken up by a lot of these issues. But if I had a crystal ball in front of me, I feel pretty comfortable, I'd say very comfortable actually, saying that a year from now, if we were to have this program, we'd be looking back on all three FTAs and a TAA reauthorization having been passed. But I'll say the middle period is a little bit murky to me, exactly how it gets done.
Tim, how do you see the debt ceiling issue affecting things going forward?
I see affecting it in two ways. One is just the basic bandwidth issue I alluded to before. You know, a lot of the same folks who have to make decisions and in some cases actually be negotiating on the debt ceiling and spending issues are also the same people who have to make decisions on all these trade issues. And, you know, so you can't have people in the same place at the same time. People can chew gum and walk at the same time, and so I don't think it's necessarily a doomsday scenario from bandwidth perspective. But, you know, you could see the debt limit issue playing out for even longer than people expect. I mean, it may be that you have short-term extensions and whatnot. So it crowds a calendar away from work and what might get done on this. I don't see trust issues necessarily bleeding over where if the negotiations are going badly on the debt limit, it will necessarily affect too much to whether there can be leaps of faith by one part or the other on a lot of these trade issues. I think the other linkage, however, will be the fact that the debate on the debt limit is about spending and money, and TAA is also about spending and money. And yes, the FTAs have to be paid for, but they're not really put in that sort of fiscal basket in any way, shape, or form, or in theory they have to be paid for, I guess. And I think that will that underscores why the votes weren't there when it was brought up earlier. And that's going to be, that's a real challenge.
Walter, let's talk about the larger strategic implications of the Core FTA for a moment. Korea has a very robust FTA policy. They're currently negotiating with Australia, New Zealand, Turkey, among others. Could you give us a brief sort of update on where those talks are and then how the Core FTA fits into Korea's larger strategic picture?
Korea is a very active for the FTA, and we are getting many benefits from the FTA already. So now Korea is having the negotiations, FTA negotiations with Australia, as you have just said, New Zealand and Turkey, and trying to broaden its partnership with other countries too. But one of the senior officer, Mo Fed, told me that the chorus is most important. So without chorus, we cannot go advance for the other FTA. So after we ratify chorus, then we can accelerate our speed on about our other FTAs. So actually our administration, especially the trade ministry, thinks and guess that by the end of this year, they may come to the conclusion with some countries' FTA. But the precondition is before that we have to ratify the chorus so that Korea can try another FTA. Let me introduce another story. China is very consistently and very strongly asking to Korea for Korea-China FTA. Still, Korea is a little bit prudent. Korea-China trade amount last year in 2010 it was $200 billion. Which is more than the sum of Korea-US and Korea-Japan trade amount. So Korea and China started the civil level research. So now Korea-China have completed cooperative research for FTA at the civil level. But we did not start the government level negotiation yet. In April,
they had a Boao Forum, which is called Asia's the World Economic Forum in Swiss Davos. There, the Hu Jintao, they called that Korea and China need to take the first steps toward the Korea-China FTA. Japan is also the eager for the Korea-Japan FTA. I think this is also not taking enough steps. And since 2003, based on the agreement of three countries, there had been a research for Korea-China-Japan Triangle FTA, but this is not giving us enough steps yet, no results yet. So, for your information, in the last year, in 2010, Korea's trade surplus with China was $45 billion. So that's why China is strongly asking FTA to Korea. And while we had a trade deficit with Japan, the amount was $28 billion. So this is the situation in Korea for the other FTAs with other countries.
Thank you, Walter. Mm. All right, Brian, Tim, could you provide us some perspective in terms of what the course FTA moves forward means for the United States strategically in Asia, where a lot of economic growth will take place, and also what it means for the broader trade agenda for the United States?
I think it'd be obviously a huge positive for the U.S. broader strategic, economic, and political relations. That's one of the reasons it launched it in the Bush administration. It's a large economy. It's the largest FTA economically since NAFTA.
Sorry, it's the largest FTA economically since NAFTA, and it's in a corner of the world that is incredibly important. I think just it's strategically incredibly important as between the two countries that fought a war together and are democratic allies to bind them closer over time. And then economically, it's footprint or a beachhead in Asia, and I think will be key to competing with China over the next generation. So it's I think it's critical. I think I'm intrigued to hear that China's continuing to show interest in an FTA with Korea, and I think it's driven by this FTA. In fact, what I recall was the day we actually closed the chorus. Chinese leaders were in the press that day talking about wanting to start negotiations with Korea. So given all of the negotiations that are going on in Asia for free trade agreements, bilateral, plural, the CORUS is key in keeping the U.S. In the game in the long term, that and in the region that doesn't necessarily involve thousands of troops. And I think, the same thing undergirds TPP negotiations.
I don't really have anything to add. I agree. Very important.
All right. Well, before we move to questions then from the audience, is there anything that we should know about the process under TPA to be aware of, things to look forward to in terms of signposts?
I can walk through. What happens first is you have this, we call it informal process, where you have a draft bill the administration will share with the congressional committees, and they'll walk through it. That's when Tim talks about technical discussions, that's really what's happening now. They're making sure that the FTA has been translated properly into implementing legislation. They'll walk through the committees. There will be hearings. The House, I think, has already had all of their hearings on the three FTAs. The Senate is having its first hearing next week, next Wednesday, on the Colombia Free Trade Agreement. They'll have hearings on all three. Concurrently, they'll do this informal process. They will ultimately have what's called a I love this Orwellian term, the non-process, or the they'll have a non-markup or a mock markup, which works just like a regular markup, but it's really a recommendation from the committee to the administration on what implementing bill the administration should ultimately submit. Members will offer amendments. Some may get adopted. If they're adopted, it goes to the administration as a recommendation. So that is, by the way, a whole other level of interesting possibilities there. Once the mock marks have taken place, then the president can formally submit the implementing this legislation. That starts the fast track clock. And the way fast track, well, the TPA clock, sorry, let's get to how long I've been doing this. Both bills, H.R. number bill, S. number bill, H.R. on the House, S. in the Senate. The S-numbered bill in the Senate is effectively a dead letter because trade agreements are revenue measures. They have to start under the Constitution of the House of Representatives. So really, the bill in the House is what matters. That bill is referred to the Ways and Means Committee. The Ways and Means Committee has 45 days to report it out one way or the other. If not, if they don't report it out, it's discharged, goes to the House floor. The House then has 15 days to vote on it. Goes to the Senate, referred to the Senate Finance Committee. Finance has 15 days to report it out. If not, it's discharged. And then the full Senate floor has 15 days to vote on it. So that's where you will often hear the 90-day fast-track clock. In practice, it usually takes much less time than that. And those are session days. So it's the days that these houses are actually in session that matter. So the August recess doesn't count, and Saturdays, Sundays, those don't count.
Thank you. It's always a very complex process, so sort of hearing how it's laid out is useful. All right. With that, I'd like to take and give our audience opportunity to ask questions. Yes, the gentleman right here in the fourth row. Right to your right, over here.
Thanks.
If you could state your name and affiliation, too.
Sure. Thank you for coming today. My name is Justin Miller. I'm with the White & Case International Trade Group. I have a question about the TPA process with respect to the agreement with Korea. How is the December 3rd supplemental agreement going to fit into this process, given that it was accorded after the expiration of TPP?
It's not a part of the FTA formally, but the implementing bill, the language of TPA says that what needs to go into the implementing bill is the changes in U.S. domestic statutory law that need to be made that are necessary or appropriate to bring the U.S. into compliance with its international obligations under the FTA. Necessary or appropriate means what everybody sort of deems to be necessary or appropriate, and in this case, the implementing bill will include the statutory changes to implement the additional negotiation.
It's a good question, though. This is something Gentleman Tim and I have thought about actually quite a bit.
Right here.
Hi, thanks. Matt Schull from Inside U.S. Trade. You all talked about the issue of obviously TA is a big issue. You talked about it. You talked about the funding is obviously going to be an issue. Do you have an idea what is being considered right now for the pay force for TAA, or is that still kind of under debate? And then also you did, Mr. Pomper did bring up the issue of the FTAs and paying for the FTAs. Does that, does that fall under that House PAYGO rule? I mean, are the FTAs really, is that the pay force for those, you think, really going to come up, this time around? As you said, they haven't in the past, but there's all these pressures with the budget. I mean, do you think that that's really going to be an issue, and what could be used to pay for those? Thanks.
So in terms of what the pay force are, not only do I not know, I don't think the members of Congress have any idea. I think it's going to be a latter term issue once you get through these sort of sequencing issues. But in terms of the House rules, my understanding actually, first of all, the House is no longer PAYGO, the House is CUTGO. You have statutory PAYGO still in the Senate. And my understanding is under the CUTGO rules, FTAs are explicitly exempted. So you don't have this problem so much in the House, but you do in the Senate. So I think in practice, they are going to be paid for in some fashion, but I don't think anybody really has an idea about how. I think it's yet another obstacle, but I think it's something that it's a lesser obstacle than some of the other bigger issues I think we've been discussing.
Bernard, right here.
Thanks, Troy. I want to pick up where Tim left off. You just touched on the TPP at the very end of what you said a few moments ago. From what I understand, the USTR view is that TPP begins, if anything's going to begin, you start with the chorus based upon that, but it moves up from there in terms of expectations, requirements, and so on. My question essentially is this. Japan is slowed down. We know that nothing's going to happen until at least August and so on the U.S. side. Japan will probably lead it until the beginning of this next year. But the process of TPP, this president seems to want something because Corus was his predecessors and so on. Where do you all see, but Tim in particular, is the TPP real? Is something going on there? Or is this just open?
It's real. A lot is going on there. They don't have trade promotion authority for it, and that's a big problem. And I don't know the solution to that problem. I know a lot of Republicans are already saying that if the administration wants to get TAA. TAA has traditionally traveled with TPA, and therefore we should talk about TPA also. And I'm sure TPP would be a part of those conversations. A purpose of TPA. But there's definitely a lot going on. High amounts of energy. It's real, but that's a big that's a problem because only Jordan, I think, is the only FTA that's ever been, in recent memory, enacted without without trade promotion protections, and Jordan had particular political winds behind it that aren't going to exist with a much more complex negotiation like TPP. But
I agree with him. It's real. There's a lot of actually pretty interesting thinking going on in terms of new elements in TPP. There's a real focus on small and medium-sized enterprises. There's supply chain issues. I think this idea of regulatory coherence is very interesting. A lot of good thinking going on, and obviously there's been a lot of work done. So I do think it's real. I think the fact that there is no implementing legislation, TPA by another word, is not just a problem because it would lack any protection in the Senate from amendment. And this is a pet of mine, a pet issue that some of you may have heard me talk about before, but it's a problem because we don't have guidance in terms of what our negotiators should be negotiating. The last time we had authorizing legislation was 9 years ago, and things have really changed. You've had, among other things, the May 10th agreement in the interim, and the world looks quite a bit different in 2011 and it does in 2002. So I often scratch my head and wonder, how do the U.S. negotiators know precisely what to negotiate? And the response is, well, because we have a very robust schedule of consultations with the Congress. And they do, no doubt about it. But my question then is, well, how does the Congress know what they're asking for? Because we haven't had to have this discussion among ourselves about what we want our trade policy to be. And I'm taken with your comment about chorus being the base, in particular with respect to what I'm discussing here, because I can tell you in the intellectual property sphere, this is exactly what there are quite a few companies are saying, and interest stakeholders are saying. Chorus should be the model for TPP. The controversial IP issues were not tabled yet. The rest of the IP chapter was, but they haven't been tabled yet. They're going to be tabled probably in June in Vietnam. And they're controversial. So it's not clear at all that the administration is going to use the chorus IP chapter. I think there would be quite a few stakeholders who would be delighted with that, but that has not been decided. And again, I think it feeds into this problem that I'm talking about, where we haven't figured out what we want a modern day IP chapter to be.
Can I follow up for a second?
Yeah, real briefly.
I mean, the notion is that Japan will have to move if once the chorus is wrapped up. Then price. Tell me what you think on that. Not in the chorus. Say something about that.
Well, let me reframe that issue slightly. If TPP becomes sort of the large, broad-based Asia-Pacific agreement people hope it is, eventually you will have these larger economies who come in who might not, we'll say, be willing to take and meet exactly the template that might be produced right now. How will you deal with Japan and rice, or you know, Korea and rice, if Korea at some point were to join, these sort of larger, sticky kind of issues?
No pun intended. Japan's obviously trying to recover. They've got other things. They've got a tragedy they're dealing with, and they've got other things they're dealing with. I suspect that the debate about TPP in Japan is just doesn't have the force that it did just a few months ago. Take it as a given. It's a different negotiation. It's much more multi-layered than a bilateral negotiation that you had in chorus. So of course it won't be the same in many respects, which cuts both ways. Actually, I tend to think that we did not like not doing anything in the specific context of the FTA on rice in chorus. That was an extremely difficult decision, and one that I didn't think we would actually take. And like any negotiation, you cross bridges and do leaps of faith that you'd never imagine you'd think you'd do. And you look at the package as a whole. I'd be very surprised if that model is what was followed or allowed in TPP. Because pull a string on a sweater, and a lot of different areas are going to make the same argument. So now, I say that with the benefit of not being in the room anymore and not being that close to it, and sort of opining from stages, as opposed to having to be part of a tough decision making process. So I don't have a sense of sort of where the feeling is on how that'll all work out, but that's sort of my gut reaction.
Chris,
thanks. Great discussion, guys. I actually took notes, so I'm in good shape here if I can read them. The title of the meeting is could we have wrong turns, and I find myself thinking, what's up with the larger issues with not necessarily between the U.S. and South Korea, but as you know, we've got this debate that's being carried out in the blogosphere and in conferences every other day on food aid, for example, which goes to the heart in some ways of the split between the Korean Democratic Party and the GNP on how to deal with North Korea. As you were saying, the Korean Democratic Party thinks Kaesong goods should be allowed in. Chorus almost got a perhaps illegal House amendment a couple of weeks ago in House Foreign Affairs when Brad Sherman got his anti-Kaesong language embedded in a North Korea sanctions bill. So I'm wondering if there's some useful things we could think out loud about today on how things like management of the U.S.-South Korea relationship, as they both try to deal with our dear friends in Pyongyang. Is that something that might crop up, and would the food aid debate be an impediment there, because Lee Myung-bak is currently not happy about it until he hears an apology from, we all know the arguments. The NARCs are not about to apologize, although boy, they sure want the food aid, blah, blah, blah. So should we also have that kind of complication floating around in our minds when we're looking at all these very important issues we're discussing? Thank you.
So that is not directly related to chorus.
Right. But
Yes, the first, the in Germany, the North Korean, the was a Lee Gun came there, and the Thomas Pickering and others there. Yeah. So you mentioned about the first was the apology from Pyongyang is the critical. Yes, so far, the we let me say this first. We have a very strong tie and concert with between the Washington and Seoul. So now after the Lee Myung-bak became president and the Obama became president, two presidents are enjoying very dear personal friendship. So based on this very strong dear friendship and the very strong cooperation between two governments, I mean two administrations, so everything is the cooperatively done. I think that the we also know that it's time for a dialogue or conversation with North Korea. But it is true that still the Lee Myung-bak administration is asking Pyongyang about the apology-like things. But the, we may the, find something before Korean South Korean administration had asked the word of apologizement from Pyongyang. But the, recently, you may read some the articles in this paper that the, we are asking not the exact word of apologize, instead the understandable measures by Pyongyang regarding Cheonan vessel and the Yeonpyeong artillery shelling. So the of course, Lee Myung-bak, the administration understands for a peaceful the way or the peaceful path for the Korean Peninsula, we need to talk to North Korea. But this, up until now, the, no answer from Pyongyang and the, no understandable and acceptable behaviors from Pyongyang. This is blocking us. And the other thing is food aid. WEP is now the ready to offer food to Pyongyang, and it seems that the Korean administration is still a little bit reluctant to totally agree there, because the, still we are the thinking the distribution of food is not transparent. Transparency of distributing the food to North Korean ordinary people. It's not enough. So if that kind of the conditions are clarified, then we will agree. So please understand that is my personal view. Yes, I'm not a government official, so personal view. So we need to check that first. There are many the news from inside from North Korea too, and the rumors that all the foods are distributed to North Korean people, and after WEP officials go back to Pyongyang, and the Workers' Party or the military forces to pull out the food again. So the, we are not opposing the food aid, I mean the human aid, such things. But the precondition should be the taken by this.
All right, well, thank you. I think we've had a very interesting discussion this morning. There's a lot of issues that came up literally in the last 24 hours, so this ended up being well-timed to sort of try to sift through at least the first reactions to what's taking place. And if you'll join me in thanking our very distinguished panel this morning.
Thank you. Good.